Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, it's great to have Tim Grover on the podcast. Tim is the CEO of Attack Athletics, Inc., which he founded in 1989, and author of the international bestseller Relentless, From Good to Great to Unstoppable. World-renowned for his work with Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Dwayne Reed, and thousands of athletes and business professionals, he appears around the world as a keynote speaker and consultant to business leaders, athletes, and elite achievers in every field. His latest book is called Winning, The Unforgivable Race to Greatness. Tim, thanks for being on the Psychology Podcast today.
This is an honor. Thank you very much. When I wrote this book, Winning, I was like, okay. And I don't know if the publicist or the book publisher reached out to you guys or you reached out to them. And I was like, seriously? They want to talk to me about this?
Of course.
I was like, okay.
Well, the mind game, you know, it's all about, what would you say is like in the percentages and all the work you've done that, and I know there's the physical game, but early in your career, did you really try to get into the mind of the competitors that you know?
Yes. You know, and one thing when Michael Jordan was my first professional client, I should say. And, you know, he would always say how important the mind was. So the part of our training was always to not only train the physical, but once I got to know him better and knew how to get him to do certain things and what his thought process was and how he felt about winning and working and doing all these things, then we incorporated a lot of that stuff into his training.
I love that. Well, let's start with your childhood. We're jumping the gun a little bit here. I want you to tell me a little about your upbringing, because from what I've read, you said you came to this country with your parents and you witnessed the sacrifice and the determination that they invested in your family. Can you talk a little bit about that? Where did you come from? And tell me a little about your parents, especially your father. Seems like a really interesting cat.
Yeah. So, you know, both my parents are from India. So what happened was I have an older brother. He was born in India, and then we all packed up and moved to the UK. And I was born in the UK. And then when I was 4, my mom actually left when I was about three years old. She came down to the States because she was a nurse practitioner, and there was a high demand for nurses in the States. So she was able to establish herself here. So basically my dad raised my brother and I for almost 2 years. And then when she was established, we came over with him. And the interesting part about that whole story was I remember my dad, we got in a cab, we landed at O'Hare, and I remember getting in a cab headed to the address my mom gave, and with some pretty big suitcases, because we came with everything, and my dad telling the cab driver to stop. And we weren't in the, we're like, okay, you know, I'm four. I don't know what's going on. And he told the cab driver to stop and let us out right here. And we were still a good 3 miles from our destination. And my dad just made a game out of it. And, you know, my dad was a slight individual. He's not very heavy, not very tall. Mm. And back then, remember, the luggage didn't have wheels. Mm. So he kind of made a game out of it, saying that, hey, listen, you know, I want you guys to see what America is about and see what this great city is, and kind of made like a tourist thing. And, you know, we'd move the suitcases a little bit and then stop as we got tired, moving those suitcases as we got tired. And come to find out, the reason he told the cab driver to stop, because that was all the money he had in his pocket. Mm. Wow. He didn't have any more money for the cab driver to go any farther. And
he told you this just, later on in life.
Yeah, he told me this later. He told me this later on, and I just, you know, I said, Dad, I got to ask you. So he goes, let me tell you what happened. He goes, this is exactly what happened. He goes, I had no more money. And my dad was a very accomplished professor of medicine back in India, but his education, they said, did not transfer to the teachings in the States. Mm-hmm. So he said, okay, so he goes, what kind of job can I get? And he ended up getting a job at the university at Northwestern, it was called a degreaser. That was the title. And a degreaser's job description is, after you have anatomy classes, you know, you have to dispose of the cadavers. Mm. And, you know, we're talking back in the late 60s, late 60s. So his job was, and then for people that don't know the medicine aspect of it, the cadavers are extremely heavy because, you know, with the fluids in them and all the formaldehyde and all the other stuff that they use, the chemicals they used to back then. So when you have to dispose of them, you just can't put them in the garbage. You have to literally incinerate them. So his job was to dismantle the cadavers and throw them into the furnace and keep out the furnace. Now, the interesting part about that whole story is we couldn't afford babysitters. My mom worked at night. My dad worked at the daytime. So when we were off from school, you know, obviously regulations weren't like they were now. My dad would take us, my brother and I, he would take us to work with him. And so I got to visually see what he was doing. And he said, no matter what happens, you have to be able to provide for your family. He goes, this is not the ideal situation for me, but this is what I need to do to provide my family. And there's certain things, no matter how young you are, that just stick with you. You know, people, you may not have other memories, and you'll know more about this than I will. You know, I don't know how that all works, but you may not have other memories of what happened when you were younger, but there's certain moments that you just don't forget.
Yeah, they're called mnemonic memories.
Okay.
M-N-E-M-O-N-I-C. Yeah. So sounds like you have quite a bit of these mnemonic memories. And they really shaped your values and your whole system you even put into place eventually with your business. Yeah.
Exactly. I always said there's watching my parents do what they do, how they made time for us, how they sacrificed, how hard they worked. You know, we didn't have everything, but we had everything we needed. Mm. And it just kind of that stuck with me. You know, people talk about seeing their parents go from from nothing to actually making something. I had two parents that did that, that changed the system of how the culture was, you know, for my dad to be the first individual to say, hey, I'm not staying in India, you know, tell his mom I'm leaving and be the first one. People always call me a rebel for what I did. Well, I always tell my dad, well, look who I learned it from. I watched you do it.
May I ask, is he still alive?
He is not. He passed. It's going on 3 years now.
Yeah. 3 years. My condolences.
Thank you.
Is your mom still alive?
Yes, my mom is still alive. Yes.
And she must be so proud of what you've become. And I mean, did she get like tickets to the Bulls games, you know? Yeah.
So here's a crazy part about that story. So coming from the Indian culture, you have two career choices back then. Doctor being one and a doctor being number two. You know, later on, they was like, okay, if you want to be a lawyer, you can be a lawyer. Then they opened up more to engineering and, you know, different things. But back then, that was it. So when I went to college, like any other college individual, I kind of had an idea what I wanted to do. And my parents always said, you know, he's going to medical school. I told my dad, I said, I don't want to go to medical school. He goes, well, what do you want to do? I said, I want to train professional athletes. And he was like, what is that? He goes, I don't even know what that means, because obviously in those years, training was not, it hadn't evolved like it has now, where you have a bunch of, you have a lot of professional athletes that have their own trainers and do, you know, have their own consultants and so forth. So this was groundbreaking for me. And he goes, I'll let you pursue that, but you have to do one thing for me. I said, what's that? He goes, you must take the entrance exam for medical school. I said, no problem. I said, I will take that. So this is how keen my dad was. When I first took the exam, I totally bombed it on purpose. On purpose. And I got the scores. I showed my dad. My dad goes, yeah, nice try. He goes, I've already signed you up for the next test. He goes, I knew you were gonna do this. And then I scored fairly high on the next one. I did get accepted into different schools, but I still chose not to go. I still chose not to go. And even, you know, you said my mom and dad, they're proud, but they were so accustomed to you go to work, you have paid vacation, you have insurance. You have a 401k. So for them, that was success for them in their mind. To know you have something steady, you have income coming in, that's how you take care of your family. With me, it's, I don't even know where the next check is coming in. And I like it that way. That's what my win is. That's what my chase is, to constantly figure out what's next. What other arenas can I win in?
Sure. You said in your book that you were the fat kid when you were young. And can you tell me what changed from being the fat kid? Like, how did you morph from that into a pretty good basketball player until you had an injury? I know that you had an injury that kind of put a stop to it. But what happened in between those two things?
Well, so if you've been involved with an Indian family, they love to eat. And when you go to another Indian family, they make sure you eat. So if you visit two or three Indian families over the weekend, you have to eat in every single place. Otherwise, it's disrespectful. And being in India back then, food wasn't as plentiful. So it was something that my parents wanted to make sure we had enough of. And I ate. I definitely ate. The transition came when I went to high school. So when I started in high school, my transition for the high school that I wanted to go to, the commute was over an hour away. And that, it wasn't a drive. That was taking two buses, taking a bus, taking a train, taking another train, and then taking another bus to school. So going to school, making the basketball team, having to do my studies, come back on public transportation again, kind of limited the amount of free time I had and the amount of food that was available to me, because your grades could not slip. Your grades could not slip. And I really enjoyed playing basketball. So I got into this. I always kind of worked out, but I got into this nice workout. I got into this nice workout regimen. And in order to be able to be a player on the team and not just sit down, I had to drop. I just ended up dropping weight. And I had one of those coaches. Oh, I never, he ran us. Boy, did he run us. You ever work out so much, you're too tired to eat, but you just forget to eat. Just like, I don't even want to lift anything in my life. I don't. That was his philosophy.
What position did you play?
Well, I played point guard. You know?
Wow.
I used to be 6 feet, but through some injuries now, I'm probably closer to, I say 5'11 now.
I'm going to tell you something I don't tell many people on this podcast, but I think you'll get a kick out of it. So I grew up with Kobe Bryant and was on the basketball team. I was the center in middle school at Bowkinwood Middle School. And
wow.
I've never grown beyond, I thought I was going to be NBA. I thought like all this stuff, you know, I never grew ever again. And then I eventually got cut from the freshman team in high school, even though Kobe actually was kind enough. He signed, you know, to let me try out for the team and he encouraged me. I didn't get accepted. So I changed into a whole different realm of being a nerd. But I thought you'd get a kick out of that story.
That is awesome. That is so funny.
Yeah.
I didn't even know we had that in common.
Yeah. Yeah. Now you know.
Kobe Bryant, but I got to see him play quite a bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You contributed to his success even. So.
Yes. I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. But like I always say, and you know, like from a psychology standpoint, the greater the athlete is, or the greater the individual is, the greater the more successful the CEO is, the more successful the teacher is, the more coachable they are, the more they're willing to learn, the more they're willing to explore things, because they know that chase to win over and over again requires you to be different, requires you to have more knowledge, more ability, the ability not only to think for yourself, but to understand what others are telling you. And the top of the top individuals that I've worked with, athletic and business-wise, they are the most coachable people out there. They understand what works for them, what doesn't work for them. They know exactly what they need. They don't know what they need. It's the middle of the road individuals that are constantly want to have discussions with you and want to do things only their way.
Mm. Such a good point. I've noticed that too, just in my own coaching of personal coaching. But yeah, I hear
you. You look at the very few teams, professional teams, corporations have trouble with the high achievers. They don't. It's always the ones in the middle or the ones in the lower that end up causing more distractions than anybody else.
So you like to work with people who are already at the top. Like, I feel like that's your preference. Is that right?
I enjoy that, because the challenge for me, the win for me, is to take somebody who's already so elite at what they do and increase that ability. You know, you can take an athlete, you can take a business, and if they're in mediocrity or average, you can show pretty good gains in that. But to take an individual who's already, or a company or CEO that's so elite at what they do, and just to be able to show that not even 1%, it's that 0.001% gain in their abilities, in their thought process, the way they achieve things. That's the constant challenge. That's the constant challenge for me, because I really enjoy the details. And you know, the most successful people that you deal with, you hear this adage where it says, don't sweat the small stuff. They sweat everything. Yeah. Because the one detail that's not important that you say, oh, it's not important, maybe the most important to them.
Yeah. Well, there's sort of like a winning mentality. You know, do you ever find there are some people with a victimhood mentality that holds them back from reaching higher levels of greatness? Like, have you ever worked with someone or seen someone who, like, everything is like a, like, every little setback is like a big, you know, they're a huge victim of some big, large thing. And then and you see that holding them back.
Yeah. And then I usually tell them, you have two choices during that thing. You can either have the victim mentality, or you can have the victory mentality.
Oh, the victory. I get it.
Yeah. Which one you want to choose. All right. The victim one is it's easy, because it's easy to blame circumstances, issues, or, you know, I didn't have this when I was growing up. I wasn't able to do this. I wasn't able to do that, because there's more people align with that information more, because there's more support in the victim category, because most people will tell you it's okay, you'll get another chance, you'll get so forth. What I always tell my athletes is, if somebody tells you it's going to be okay, are you just settling for okay? Because that's what a victim mentality will settle for. They'll settle for okay. The highest achievers, they don't want anything to be okay. They don't want anything to be fine. They're only accepting great, unstoppable, the winning mentality. And that's how they keep thinking and processing information. So they never understand the victim's mentality, because they don't want to be in the middle. There's a lot of comfort from others and from yourself that comes with the thinking or acting like you are the victim. You're always looking for somebody else to help you. You're always looking for somebody to pull you along, looking for somebody else to do the work for you. And to the point, it's even like somebody to do the actual thinking for you.
Yeah, I definitely, as we go along today, I definitely want to unpack more of the victory mentality, because I think that could even be like the title of this podcast episode. I always think in terms of like, I got a title for this one. I think that would be a good title. So are you an only child, by the way?
No, I have an older brother.
Older brother. I was going to say, opposite. Is he into sports at all?
No, well, he's into sport. He's into watching sports, but he chose the safe route. He's worked for the federal government for I don't know how many years. I've lost count. So he has the stable job.
Yeah.
Wow. The paycheck every two weeks. Well, he's got the paid vacation, he's got the sick time, he's got the 401k, he's got the retirement plan.
Amazing. He's the opposite of you.
100% complete opposite.
That's amazing. Well, you two weren't identical twins, that's for sure. okay, so this is what I want to know. It's around 1989, before we get to your work with Michael Jordan and then that whole career, what I want to understand is your vision as a young man of helping professional athletes. Tell me about this vision you had, and how did you get this vision? I mean, like talk me through 1988, talk me through 1987. I want to know, like, do you know what I'm saying? Talk me through the years right before the Pistons in 89 inspired you. Yeah.
So my education is, I have a master's degree in exercise science, a bachelor's degree in kinesiology, which is all related to exercise and working out and body movements and so forth. I knew all my education taught me what to think. This was the book. This is what you do. Here it is. And this is how you go along. But I had no experience. I didn't have an experience. So what I did was, once you finish school, there's no way my dad's going to let me just sit around the house. You got to do something. You got to find a job. So I took a job, and I didn't want, the university actually offered me a position, you know, nice pay and everything, but I was like, this is not what I want. This is not what I want to do. So I passed on that, and I took a job at a local health club. The minimum wage there back then was $3.35. $3.35 with a master's degree.
Wow.
So I took the job because I knew what to think. Because my school told me what to think. I didn't know how to think. So what I mean by that, and we talk about this in Winning quite a bit, is I knew everything from a science standpoint of what athletes, how they should move, what they should do, but I didn't know how to implement my own stuff into it, my own thoughts, my own ideas. So that was one of the reasons I took that job in a health club, so I could become a, even though I had the education, I still had to pass the test and wait my turn to become a trainer there. Then when I became a trainer there, I started to work with individuals, and I really started to get the really get results and started to do things that weren't, that other individuals hadn't seen or they were accustomed to. And then from there, I made a transition. You know, I started work. Most of the individuals I started training were men. Then I ended up working with a woman who had just had a baby. I ended up getting her in great shape. So then I became the post, you know, I became the postnatal guy. Hey, this is the person you need to hire. So each transition allowed me to give me the ability of how to think and do things differently. And then I saw this article in the paper where how Michael was tired of taking the physical abuse from the Detroit Pistons. So I was like, oh, you know what? I'm sure they'll find somebody. I was like, you know, there's an opening here. So what I did was, I wrote 14 letters. There's 15 players on a basketball team. 12 active, three they used to be on the injured list. And I wrote 14 letters. Back then, remember, no emails, no cell phones, none of that stuff, no social media. And I sent the letters, put them in the mailbox. The only person I didn't write a letter to was Michael Jordan. Because I was just like, he's so talented, he's so good. Why is he going to work out with somebody that's never worked out with a professional athlete? All right. He found this letter in somebody else's locker. Pulled the letter out and told the athletic trainer and the team doctor at that time, find out what this guy's about. So the staff reached out to me. We went back and forth for 3 months. They put me through more extensive testing in those 3 months than I did in my time in college. And they didn't tell me who was interested in working with me. So, you know, I'm thinking, I don't know who it is. I'm thinking it's one of the lower end players, and he needs some special attention. They want to bring him along. So after 3 months, they say, hey, we want you to, here's the address. We want you to meet the client at this particular location. Okay, it was his house. You know, back then it was a house. It was still a nice house, but it didn't have security gates. It didn't have the number 23 on it. You just could walk up to it, and you rang the doorbell. So I walk up to it, I ring the doorbell, and Michael Jordan opens up the door. Be the last time Michael's ever answered the door by himself.
How did you feel?
Well, fortunate. I'm not a starstruck person.
Okay.
I was not a starstruck. And here's, it's so much easier to find information on Michael than it was any of the other players, because he was constantly in the paper, he was constantly in magazines, he was constantly on TV, on interviews. So whether you wanted to study him or not, it was kind of always in your face. So just by watching that, I was kind of like, okay, I know what he needs to play, how he can excel himself even more. So we sat down, and we went back and forth with a bunch of questions for about almost 40, 45 minutes. And he just said, this doesn't sound right. And I said, this doesn't get any righter. I said, give me 30 days and see what let's see what happens. And 30 days turned into 15 years.
Wow. He was 26 years old at the time. I just did the Google search. So a really young man. Actually, there's a part of the story I think is really kind of cool. You realized when you first met him, you realized that you were wearing Converse shoes. Converse, and that's a no-no.
That's a serious no, especially since the two shoe companies he wanted to wear was Adidas and or Converse, and both of them said, no, we're not going to invest in you because we don't think so. You're going to be one of those players. So Nike was actually his third choice. So they even something funny about that. So when I had the shoes on, when Michael Jordan opened up the door, I'm literally trying to take the shoes while I'm looking at him. I'm trying to take the shoes off with my feet so he doesn't look down, because I know. And I eventually did take the shoes off before I went in the house. Got big old holes in my socks. So I take the socks and I turn them around. So the holes are actually on the bottom. So now you have the holes on the bottom, but you have the dirty socks. You have the dirty part on the top. I'm like, well, you know what? If he's looking at my socks, then he's not understanding what I'm saying. He's not understanding what I'm trying to put in front of him. So I need him to notice. I need him to notice me from the neck up, not from the neck down.
Yeah. And do you think he ever saw those shoes?
When I left the house, he looked at the, he did look at the shoes. He looked at the shoes down and he goes, never again.
Are you serious?
Yeah. He said, never again. I got you.
Hilarious. That's absolutely hilarious. That's a great story. Now he said of you, he said, quote, he said, this is him referring to you. Tim Grover is the biggest asshole you'll ever meet, but he knows his stuff. You said you really can't ask for a better compliment from Michael Jordan. In Michael Jordan's eyes, is being an asshole, does that have kind of maybe a different meaning? Like, does that mean like you're kind of like you're a badass motherfucker? Like, what do you think he meant by that? Yeah.
It means that like you're really confident in you're really confident in your abilities. You know what you're doing, and you're not all going to always be a yes person. You know, when you have these superstar athletes, you know, everyone around them becomes the yes person, the yes person, the yes person. And when, you know, when you're the asshole, you have to disagree. You have to say, no, this isn't right. This is how it needs to be. This is why we're doing this. And, you know, have a nice friendly confrontation, as friendly as you can get with him. And not give in to what you know is right, and be able to prove it that way. So when he said he's the biggest asshole, meaning he's not a pushover. He's going to tell you exactly. He's not going to tell you what you want to hear. He's going to tell you what you need to hear. And most athletes, and even CEOs, and you know, high performing individuals, they have a lot of friends. They don't need friends. They need allies, because friends tell you what you want to hear. Allies tell you what you need to hear. And so a lot of times your greatest allies aren't even in your friend circle, because they show up when they need to show up. They tell you what it is. They can point out where things are. You may get labeled as an asshole or whatever. I always say I'm that family member that nobody wants in the family, but everybody needs.
Well, I mean, I do have some pretty close friends who keep it real with me. So maybe,
well, you know what, you're fortunate that you're fortunate to have those individuals. And I would even put them in I wouldn't even call them friends. I would call them allies.
Allies. Yeah. Interesting.
Because allies show up no matter what kind of mood you're in, what's going on in your life. They support you through the good. They support you through the bad. They support you through the indifferent. And not only do they support you, they counsel you and they educate you and figure out ways to make you better. They don't settle for what's okay or this is fine. they understand there's more to that. And that's why you have that long lasting friendship with those individuals.
Yeah, I love that. Now, you were there through the whole Bulls dynasty. I just can't, you know, my 12-year-old self is like, you know, like going crazy right now, because I think I grew up in Philadelphia, you know, but I'd like to think I was the biggest Bulls fan in the world. You know, I mean, me and my friend Avi, we'd like everything, you know. In fact, there's even this funny story where I was like, we followed the Bulls team bus afterwards because I wanted to meet Michael Jordan. And and Michael Jordan actually did, you know, he was like really right in front of me. And I was so concerned that my friend Avi wasn't there to see it that I was like, wait here. My friend Avi's got to meet you. And Michael's like, man, I can't wait here all day, brother. Yeah. Or whatever. And it's so funny because I laugh with my friend about that, because I really cared about my friend. You know, maybe in that moment I should have been more an ally than a friend. I missed a chance. I missed a chance to talk to Michael Jordan. But anyway, you were there during this dynasty. You were front row seat. You were even like, you know, the whole like flu controversy. You were in that hotel room when they delivered the pizza. I mean, you right? Yes. You got the pizza. Good thing you didn't eat the pizza. It's a good thing you didn't eat it.
Yes.
You know,
you got your homework on this. Yeah, like you like you really.
I do. I do a lot of preparation for my guests, and I.
Obviously. Yes.
I read.
As Michael would say, evidently, that's his word.
Evidently. Oh, nice. I read every word of your new book and watched interviews with you. So that is really interesting. There's so many different kinds of like little nuggets and stories that wouldn't serve the psychology podcast, but just my 12-year-old self who's like, I want to know what it was like to be there, front row seat. Can you just give me like an overall impression of what it was like to be there during one of the most exciting winning moments in the history of sports?
I mean, it's kind of undescribable. Yeah. I mean, the things that you talk from a psychological standpoint, being able to watch one of the greatest athletes, if not the greatest athletes of our time, handle all these different things, and knowing what he had to go through, not only physically but mentally, and how he used everything as a learning process and as a fuel process. You know, in the book, I don't know if it's in the book, but I've told this story. You know, Michael, he was actually allowed to pull into the arena because of all the fanfare and all this other stuff. He would always stop. He would always pull the car outside because there were fans that were lined up all the way around the gate. And he would always say, never showed up in a dirty car, was impeccably dressed. And he would literally get out of his car and wave to the people around him because it was like, this might be the only opportunity these individuals get a chance to see me. They may never be able to afford a ticket, in the game. Right. And this is as close as if I can brighten up their moment for that moment. And to think about to understand that mentality going into every single game, you know, every game to him, it wasn't just a game. It was the game. It was the game. I mean, the one thing I always said, Michael, every single game he played, whether it was preseason, playoffs, middle, he always gave us an aha moment. You were like, wow. It was just like, and then for me, I got so spoiled. I would see those things so frequently that you kind of just get, you kind of like, you get used to it. You get spoiled from it. And then occasionally he would just do something that you were just like, wow. But for me, it wasn't as enjoyable as a fan, because I was watching with such intensity to see how he was moving, how, you know, to watch the way his ankle was positioned, the way his knee, how his hips were, how his fingers. I was paying attention to stuff that other individuals just wouldn't pay attention to. Mm. So it's kind of difficult to sit there and watch the game as a fan. And then when he would do something exciting, which was on a regular basis, the people in front of you would stand up. I'm like, sit down. Because when he scored, everybody claps when he scores the basket. But I need to see from a performance standpoint, well, when he scored the basket, did he pivot right or did he pivot left after the basket? Because I need to have those calculations down, because I can't determine tomorrow's workout until I have all those details down. And, you know, just to see, the best way to describe it is you weren't at a basketball game. You were at a performance. It was like you were at a Broadway play or the opera or the theater or something, and you were coming to see this unbelievable person, this unbelievable performer do his thing. And back then, if you looked at the courtside seats, you know, people they would literally dress up on the weekends. They would literally dress up as though it's a night out of town. You would see individuals in their business suits. You would see the young ladies dressed up, in their gowns and their dresses and everything. It was like literally going to a performance. I don't know the last time you went to a game, but this was the funniest part about it. At halftime, by the time the second half started, everybody was in their seats. Everybody, because they did not want to miss a moment. Now you go to arena, people are hanging out in there. Well, before the pandemic, they're hanging out in the tunnels. You know, they're waiting to use the bathroom. They're waiting to do all this other stuff. Back then, everybody was in their seats because they just didn't know what was going to go next. And the constant flash of, you know, and before every game, they used to have this announcement that say, "No flash cameras, please." Yeah, right.
Yeah, come on. I went to some of those games, and I never went to a Chicago game, and I'm remiss about that. But when he came to play Philly, you know, I was there in the nosebleed sections watching Jordan. Yeah.
Although you talk about an intense rivalry over there. Oof.
Yeah. Barkley.
Yes, one of his favorite places to play. Absolutely, because, you know, everybody compared him to Julius Erving, Dr. J, and Dr. J being from Philly. So yeah. He was like, you know, this is like, I have to pay respect to the man that they're comparing me to. Not only do I have to pay respect to that man, I have to outdo what that man did on that court. And what Julius Erving did was very special.
Yeah, very special for sure. Okay, let's talk about Kobe a little bit. Where did you first meet Kobe? And I think it was like a fish store or something, a sushi store.
Yes. Right? So I started with him in 2007. He had reached out to Michael and said, "Hey, listen, I'm having severe issues with my knees." And he goes, "I just don't know what to do. I've tried everything. And, you know, I need some help here." He goes, I can't continue to play with how bad my knees are hurting. And Michael and I had already finished our work. He was in the retirement, and he just said, he goes, "You know, give my guy a call, you know, give Grover a call." And what you described earlier, that was what he told Kobe. Was like, he said, "Well, tell me about Grover." He said, "Listen, Grover really knows his stuff, but he's the biggest asshole you'll ever meet." Well, Kobe and MJ had the same mentality, so he kind of understood. So I flew out to California, and right near the restaurant there was a little sushi place to go get something to eat. So I sit down there. I'm sitting in there with my family. And we go down, we're eating something, and here literally Kobe Bryant comes walking in to pick up a takeout order. I introduced, we had met before briefly, and he knew of me, and he remembered the face. So I introduced myself, "Hey, da, da, da," and, you know, "Welcome," and all this other. But that was our first meeting. And he goes, when you ready, when you ready, he goes, let me know when you're ready to start. I said, we can start tonight if you want to. He goes, we'll start tomorrow. I said, that's perfect. And this is a story that didn't make it into the book. So he said, I'll see you at 3:30. But everybody else would have assumed it was 3:30 p.m.
Yeah.
But just like you did your homework on me, I did my homework on him, and I knew it was 3:30 a.m.
A.m. Yeah.
And that was the test. That was Kobe testing me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was Kobe testing me. If I would have showed up at 3:30, he would have sent me home. Because one of the things in the interview that when word got out that we were working together, one of the reporters asked him and said, well, hey, you know, you hired MJ's trainer. How's it going? He goes, he ain't done shit for me yet. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah. He goes, yeah, I know what he's done for MJ and what he's done for other individuals, but that's for those individuals. What has he done for me?
Wow.
And you know, that's kind of like the psychology of the next win. All right. When you get that win, what is that next win going to do for you? And how are you going to get there? Just because you did it one way or you did it a different way or a previous way for a different company or an individual doesn't mean that's going to work for that individual.
Yeah.
You know, because the psychology of the way they think, the way they move, the way they interact is totally different. And I was actually honored that he said that because I didn't want him to go off of what I did in the past. I wanted him to go off of the results that I got for him.
Yeah. Well, you got him results. Yeah. Well, yeah. Tell me about the phone call you had with him 1 week before he died.
This one's a little tough. So,
yeah.
You know, the All-Star game was going to be in Chicago, and he had already transitioned from basketball into his life of, you know, entrepreneurship, author, script writer. You know, he'd already won an Oscar, won numerous awards for his children's series of his books. And he was fully invested in the business world. So we texted back and forth and, you know, we always said we're going to see each other. Yeah. But you know, his schedule was busy. I was busy and it never kind of happened, but we made plans because he was going to come to Chicago for some business during the office. We had made plans to get together. Mm. And it never happened.
Yeah. It's unimaginable, isn't it?
Yeah. And even when I got the news, I was like, I'm thinking this is fake news. This is something else. And then other people reached out to me and people that were close to him and, you know, different people that was like, no, this is real. Mm. This is real. And it didn't, literally probably 3 days later, that's when it kind of finally hit me, you know, because with him, you'd always be like, he's going to find a way to beat this. Mm. It's just, this isn't right. It isn't true. And then 3 days later, that's when it like.
Yeah.
It really hit me hard. And it's still hard for me to talk about. It's still really difficult. You know, one of the things that we talk about in the book is I used to always tell him, we don't have time. We don't have time. Meaning, you know, we got to keep moving. We got to keep pushing forward. We got to keep being better than the next person. And I sit back and I think to myself, boy, I wish I was wrong. Mm. Boy, I wish I was wrong.
Did you talk to him on the phone? Did he get a chance to that week before?
Yeah, brief. It was very brief. You know, a lot of the communications were text every now and then. Yeah. But then I would tell him, I would be like, just pick up the phone. Yeah. Because, you know, people get distracted while they're texting. You can be doing something else. And plus, it's so much easier when you just get the communication in real quick. I just, you know, it's like, hey, Cole, KB, pick up the phone. I used to call him Bean, because that's his middle name. So Bean, pick up the phone. Mm-hmm. All right. And he'd pick up the phone. And then, you know, we chatted for a little bit and said, hey, listen. And what, you know, in the line we booked, says, what are you doing? He goes, man, I'm chasing that next win, just like you.
Yeah.
Always chasing the next win.
Yeah, I have a real, first of all, I just want to say, I'm really sorry that you guys, you know, I'm sorry for everyone. I'm sorry for his family. I'm sorry you guys never got a chance to have that meeting. I know it's really hard for you, and I really appreciate you talking about it with me. He touched so many people, you know, and even all of our high school friends, we were so upset. Yeah.
Whether you liked him or not.
Yeah.
You had to respect what he did.
Yeah.
You had to respect his mentality. You had to respect his work ethic. You had to respect his results. So that's, like I said earlier, it's not, yeah, you don't have to like, you don't have to like these guys. You know, everybody has their favorites and they have their fans and so forth. I mean, look at, you're in Philadelphia when he came back for that game and they booed him.
Mm, yeah.
Like his hometown. Yeah. Right. You know, stuff like that hurts. But he gave everyone something to respect about him. You know, people always say this, you know, you need to respect me. Well, I always say, you need to give me something to respect.
Right.
No one can say that he did not give each individual something to respect about him.
Yeah, for sure. I want to read a quote that you said about winning. You said, I've seen winning in all its glorious generosity and all its excruciating cruelty. One day it wears a halo, the next day it has fangs. So if you kind of sign up for the winning business, do you kind of have to also just accept that coming along for the ride are going to be these real lows of your of the quest? You know, there's going to be these moments where you feel like you're not winning at all, even.
Yes, that's why it's called the unforgiving. That's why the book is called The Unforgiving Race. Because it is unforgiving. It's unforgiving. You know, everybody sees, one of the reasons I wrote this book is the highest achievers at the top, they cherish the halo moments, but they understand the win came when winning showed up with the fangs. That's what allowed them to achieve, what allowed them to enjoy, rejoice in the win, in the halo parts. And they understand you don't have control over what winning is going to wear on that particular minute, that particular hour, that particular day. You must be ready and prepared for whatever it's going to throw at you. And it is going to throw everything at you. It's going to throw everything at you. And the individuals that can relish and understand both and know what it takes to deal with both aspects, everything, you have your up, you have your down, you have your right side, you have your left side. A car has a gas, it has a brake. There's a go, there's a stop. So why shouldn't winning accept just one of those things? You have to accept it's going to show up with both of those. And when the pandemic came through, it wore the fangs for a long time.
For sure.
And that's a lot of stuff with what you said earlier about the victim mentality. Is the victim mentality is they don't know how to deal with the fangs. They want to get to the halo, but they've never dealt with the fangs.
A lot of people learned how to deal with fangs this past year, that's for sure.
Yes. It isn't so true. Mm. So true. Yeah. And for a lot of people, that was their first experience on the fangs, like real fangs.
For sure.
This isn't baby teeth. These are like saber-toothed tiger. Like you go back into the the dinosaur days. It's that, it's coming in like stuff that you can't even imagine, you can't even see.
Yeah, this is why I love the psychological literature on what's called post-traumatic growth. I think you would really like that work in the field of positive psychology. Are you aware of the field of positive psychology?
I'm sorry?
Are you aware of the field of positive psychology? Do you read any of this literature?
I read tons of it. I read tons of it. And what I did was, I mean, I use a lot of that stuff when I train my business individuals, when I train my athletes. But again, I have to integrate some of my own teachings, my own learning, my own education, what I've learned through my experiences, and figure out the puzzle that has many, many missing pieces.
Yeah, that's great. So what's the difference between competing and winning?
So I always say this, everybody knows how to compete. You know, everyone knows how to compete. You know, so you compete for things all the time in your daily life. Everybody, you're going for this, you're going for that. You can go, I'm a competitor. Everyone says I'm a competitor. Well, most individuals are a competitor. You don't do this podcast just for fun. You're competitive. You're like, there's other podcasts that are out there like this. That are in my category. Listen, I gotta compete against them every single day. All right. But people stop at competition. They stop at competing. And that's one of the big quotes that Kobe always said. All right. Don't rest in the middle, rest at the end.
Yeah.
People that compete, they rest in the middle. People that win rest at the end, briefly.
Yeah, I think that's really profound. But, you know, I do, it's good to love what you do when you're, even if you want to win. I do love this podcast. I have an intrinsic love for it. I just happen to be the number one psychology podcast in the world, but you know, like that's just.
Oh, you just don't happen to be. There's something like that just doesn't happen. You can happen to slip and fall on some ice. You could happen to find some loose change on the ground. You don't happen to fall into the number one. This is not a lottery.
But let me ask you something, because I want to think this through with you. My goal wasn't to win. I'm very happy that it's done so well. Right. Mm-hmm. But I was driven by craft. I was driven by mastery, by wanting to engage in and with other psychologists and other intellectuals and people and really get into the science of psychology in every kind of direction. And then that kind of resonated with people. Well, it did, mm-hmm. not kind of, it did, you know, sure. resonate a lot of people. So is winning doesn't always have to be the primary goal in order to win, right? Is that right?
No, it's not. You know what I said? Listen, it's not about the glory. It's not about the payday. Right. Winning is about the obstacles and challenges and the pains you go through to get to winning. And you know what? And you have to go through those things and somebody else may get the win.
Right.
Somebody who doesn't work as hard as you do ends up getting the win. Right. Somebody who isn't as qualified for a job, they end up getting the win. So the winning is about going through the different obstacles. It's not about the glamour. It's about the grit. It's about grinding for something that you want to take form of the way you want it to take form. And that's what you did. You said, okay, listen, I'm going to put this podcast together, and this is the different people I'm going to study and interview and educate myself in a different format. So what you were doing is you were grinding, but you knew what the form of your end result was to look like. Most people just grind. And what happens if you just constantly, if somebody said, I hate this when people say, man, I'm grinding. But what are you grinding for? Because if you constantly keep grinding something, what do you end up with? You end up with dust. You end up with nothing. Well, it's just like we've all been to different parties, different events, and you've seen, you know, these fantastic ice sculptures. Well, that ice sculpture starts off as just a block that has no, it's a square or a circle or, you know, whatever it may be. And you chip away into those things. And once you chip away at those things, you can see what winning looks like. And then when you went through that whole process, and the process was required, you know, there's this adage where people always say, you know, you got to love the process. I disagree with that. The process is required. It's required. You can't get through wherever you need to get through without the process. Now, the end result, which is winning, that's not guaranteed, but you must do the process. You must, and there's not a single individual I know that loved 100% about every single process they had to do to get to that end result. But you still have to do it. You know, when you played you played basketball, I played basketball. You have to do the wind sprints. You have to be in shape. You have to be able to run.
Yeah.
Those are not fun.
No. No, they're not fun. And I'm going to read a quote of yours that I think relates to a lot of what you're saying. You said, you can be the kindest, most gentle person in the world and still be competitive in every way. This is about quiet desire. I actually really like that phrase, quiet desire. Hunger, adrenaline, pain, fatigue, envy, pressure, so much pressure. I think that relates to what you're saying.
You did. Just think about it. You didn't go through. The pressure is up in here. You know, the pressure to win, the pressure to succeed, it's all mindset. It's up in here. You know, winning and this book and what I'm trying to pass isn't just about athletes. It's about all of us. It's the mental process of what you have to go through before you even get in the race. And you went through the whole process and understood of what it was going to take. Now, then you said, you know what? Now I'm about to get in this unforgiving race. And this race is going to be unforgiving. I don't know if I'm going to win. I have no idea if I'm not going to win. But guess what? If you never got in this race, you had no chance of winning.
Hmm. Yeah. My grandmama always used to say, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Yeah.
But let me push you on something for a second, because I want to get your thoughts on this. Like, when I hear the word winning, I tend to think of something like a zero sum kind of thing, where like, in order for me to win, some other people have to lose. What if some people, you know, what if some people's goal, you know, their sense of winning is to like uplift as many people as possible? Like they're not in this like sports kind of mentality about winning. What could winning look like, you know, as you define it, in other fields where it might not be so obvious that word is, you know, like if you've started a nonprofit and you want to like, your winning is helping kids in Africa, you know, like, what does that look like? You know, does it always have to be zero sum in some way that you're tearing down a competitor? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. So that's the... when you can uplift other individuals in winning, that's the ultimate win. And
nice.
But in order to do that, in order to do that, you have to be a little bit selfish. And that's the part that people don't understand. You have to take care of self. If you look at selfish, all right, people look at that as a bad word, but they love to give different twists to it. You know, they love to give it's just like, all right, me time. All right, that's selfish. All right, that's something you're doing for self. All right, you know, my man cave. That's like leave me alone. That's my, you know, boys and girls night out. Those things lead when you explain people selfish in that way, it's acceptable. But when you, in order to take care of others, in order to take care of your teammates, in order to take care of the nonprofit, in order for other people to win, you got to take care of yourself. You got to be a little selfish on yourself. And that allows you to give more to other individuals. The more you have of yourself, physically and mentally, the more ability you have to give others. And the way Kobe described winning was, he said, winning is everything. And what did he mean by that? How do you feel when you win, when you have this sensation of a win? You're like, okay, even in a movie, you watch a movie or whatever, there's this euphoric feeling. When your kids win, same feeling. When your family wins, your same feeling. When your friends win, same feeling. When your allies win, same feeling. When the kids that you are having the nonprofit for, and you get to see them smile, their win is your win. You don't have to always tear down the individuals to get that win, but you have to understand that winning has a different language than what everybody else speaks.
Thank you so much for that clarification. I've been wanting to ask you that question, so thanks for answering that. Can you tell me a little bit what you're up to these days? You know, what fires you up the most right now in your life?
Well, you know, when we first wrote the book Relentless, a lot of the stuff that we, the media stuff different than we talked to, was more sports related. What this book has done is being able to open up doors and being able to speak to individuals like yourself and get the word out of my lessons, my teachings. This is what I want. This is what I want to do now. I want to be able to give what I saw and what I lived through and what I've experienced and what I've learned to other individuals and say, hey, it's not all about the sparkles. It's not all about the sprinkles. This is what it takes to get into the race to win. And your definition of winning could be completely different than anybody else's. I mean, I'm still in the line. I still do consulting for a lot of professional athletes and a lot of organizations. I do consulting for tons of businesses, very high level CEOs, and to watch them win.
Yeah.
Excites me. I mean, that was the biggest thing, to just to see my athletes, what they went through, for them to get that moment, and it was just a brief moment of win, to watch other individuals to win. I want to be able to see more people understand their definition of winning and what winning means to them, and it's different for every individual out there.
Beautiful. I feel like I see you, Tim Grover. You are a tough guy, but there's also this side of you, that this emotional, tender side of you, dare I say, that wants to help people realize their full potential, and that makes you feel really inspired and good. So I see you.
thank you. You know, we get individuals all the time say, "Oh, you know, your talk or your book or something, you know, It changed my life." And I always tell these individuals, I didn't change your life. You changed your life. You actually changed. You took the action. You changed your thought process. You changed your mindset. Changed your mindset. We may have assisted and helped and gave you some clarity, but none of my books tell you what to do. Your whole life, people have been telling you what to do. Psychology is about doing what you do, what makes you successful, what lights your fire, what gives you clarity up in here. And nobody can give you that. They can explain it, how other individuals do it, how this individual did, but but you still have to add. You can you can build the whole cupcake, but you still have to add the frosting and the sprinkles in order to get that desired taste of winning that you want.
Let's end there today. Tim, man, thank you so much for chatting with me today on the Psychology Podcast. And I truly wish you all the best in this book tour and with your business and helping others. You're not done helping. You're not done helping people.
I'm not. Yeah. Scott, again, thank you. Listen, thank you so much. You have no idea. This is an honor for me to do this. Not one, because it's a completely different avenue than I'm accustomed to.
Yeah.
And I won't even say two, because you're not two. You're number one. One, to be a guest on the number one podcast in the world.
Yeah.
In the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience and would like early access to new episodes, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.